On this episode of the InsurTech Geek Podcast, talking about how Asia is shaping the future of insurance with Teresa Blissing, author of The Future of Insurance, Asia Rising. The InsurTech Geek Podcast is all about technology that's transforming and disrupting the insurance world. We'll be interviewing guests and doing deep dives into specific tech we see changing the industry. We're taking you on a journey through insurance tech, so enjoy the ride and geek out. And I'm here with our special guest, live from New York City, Teresa Blissing. Teresa, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, James.
Thanks for coming on the show. It's always a pleasure having a fellow insurance geek on the InsurTech Geek Podcast, talking about insurance and technology. And ooh, it's a global business too, and that's what your book is about, Asia Rising. We're going to get to that book in a minute. Before we get to the book, we're going to talk about you.
Yeah. What do you want to know?
I just tell me about your mother. No, we're not. I'll tell you about my mom. She's great. Yeah, we talk like twice a day. She's doing awesome. I'm from South Louisiana. You're not from South Louisiana. You're also not from New York City. You're also
I'm originally from Germany.
Germany.
Yeah, just outside of Frankfurt. That's where I grew up. Yeah.
Awesome. And you've lived all over the world.
I have. So the first time I lived abroad was in 2009. At that time, I was working for Generali, the Italian insurer. And so with Generali, I worked for the Asia headquarter in Hong Kong. So yeah, back in 2009 was a different world back then. I then also lived in Bangkok, Thailand. I lived in Jakarta, Indonesia. I spent way too much time in Singapore. Before relocating to New York, I was living in Sydney, Australia. And now in New York for another 2 and a bit years. And then let's see what's next.
Yeah, you're a wanderer, huh?
Yeah, I'm not running from the law. I just want to make this clear.
I know. I mean, it looks an awful lot like some kind of evasion protocol to get away. You know, as soon as they find out who you really are, you pull up stakes and you go to the next country, right?
Correct. Yeah. No, that's we relocated to New York because my husband is working for the United Nations. So seconded to actually UN Women and going to be in New York for 3 years. So another like 2.5 more to go.
Yeah, that's awesome. So what'd you say he was doing at the United Nations?
So he's the strategic military advisor for UN Women. So that's the part of the United Nations that is taking, into consideration gender equality, etc., especially in like conflict and fragile environments. So that's what he's doing.
Awesome. That's good work. Interesting time in global democracy and politics right now. I would be remiss, and you don't have to make any comment on this if you don't want to, but I'd be remiss if I didn't express my love and concern for our InsurTech brethren in Israel right now and the entire region. It's been a very interesting last week. We've had a lot of guests on from Israel, onto the show who are either continually active in Israel or from Israel and have moved in largely New York and other parts of the United States. So, hope that the conflict resolves swiftly and peacefully. And, I'm certainly very concerned about our friends' safety and hope they and their families are well. So let's jump in back to you. So what did you grow up wanting to do as a girl in Germany? Like what was your hope and desire? Did you want to be a lawyer? Did you want to be a diplomat? Did you want to be what did you want to be growing up?
Yeah, it's a good question. I kind of wanted to keep my options open. That's also why I had Latin in school, because back then in Germany, there was a requirement if you want to become a doctor or a lawyer, you needed to have Latin to get into university. So that's why I decided to take Latin. And, you know, looking back now, it was probably the most useless language to learn, ever. But and then I ended up in insurance a little bit. Some say it was like destiny, because my parents had an insurance agency. They were running it from my childhood home. We were living on the second floor, and on the first floor there was their insurance agency. And I actually applied for a few different companies, all in like financial services, but not all insurance. But when I had my interview with Generali, and that was back in 2004, so, you know, almost 20 years, I did really like the vibe and, you know, the whole experience of the interview process. And so I decided to actually go into insurance, and quite a surprise to my parents. It's not that they were pushing me to do that, but not regretting it.
Good. Yeah, you shouldn't regret anything, right? It's the path is the path that got you there. So
yes.
What led you to write this book? I mean, first tell me a little bit about the career projection and trajectory. Like, where did you go along your career path? Because obviously, yeah. I've got your LinkedIn, and I can see nominally what the stops on the train track were. Right, I can say, okay, well, she's in New York, and we're going to back up to Sydney, and we're going to back up to these insurance companies she worked at, and you know, you had all these kind of innovation studios you've been involved with, and if you wind all the way back, you were in planning and control, any money laundering, IT security officer, your manager of international business. I mean, you really had a lot of stops along the way.
Yeah.
Right now, currently, you're a director with Accelerating Insurance. You're a lecturer and public speaker on your own. You're also founder of the Asia InsurTech podcast and InsurTech Amplified. So there's a lot of current jobs on your LinkedIn. So tell me what led to that.
Yeah, sure. So I worked 10 years for Generali, and I had different roles. As you know, I mentioned, I was planning and control. I was anti-money laundering officer, which is a role every insurance company needs to have by law in Germany. I'm actually not sure if it's the same in the US, but yet it was one of the titles I had, and you know, not something that really enables business, but more prevents business in a way. I then also worked for Generali in their Asia regional office in Hong Kong. So that was my first introduction to Asia and the Asian market, and also on, you know, what is happening in that part of the world. My last position with Generali was manager of the international business. So that was their employee benefit business together with the Generali employee benefit network. So I was responsible for the German market, but was connecting with the different offices of the Generali employee benefit network. But I found myself a little bit like, on the one hand, missing Asia, but also I asked myself, like, isn't there more in life than working for an insurance carrier? And I was also really intrigued by, you know, new innovations and new technologies coming up. So that was 2014, 2015, when really the term big data gained a lot of popularity in the insurance industry. And I, you know, remember reading all of these articles about how big data is going to change the insurance industry. And, you know, I looked at the company I worked for, and also, you know, from colleagues and peers in other organizations, there was no big data in insurance. There was not even, you know, small data. There was siloed data. There was, you know, a lot of fragmented data all over the place that nobody could really access. And so I decided to take a break, go back to university. I did my MBA, and I took the time to do an academic research study on the adoption of big data, because something that I have learned, and during my time with Generali, I was also working on a major merger between the German entity of Generali and a German insurer, which was called Volksversorger. And during that time, I already realized how difficult it is for people to change their behavior and ways of working and adopt new processes, etc. So that's how I really looked at the adoption of big data from like a change management perspective, and understanding how, frankly, any innovation or any new technologies can be adopted. What are the challenges, etc. And that was my gateway into everything tech and innovation and insurance. And I then decided not to go back working for an insurance carrier, but switched careers a little bit, started working in management consulting. I then worked also with a lot of startups. I worked with different universities and startups accelerators in the Asia region. And yeah, really, really enjoyed that work. And that was also the time where Michael Waitz and I founded the Asia InsurTech podcast to really bring some of these stories to the world.
So tell me about your current status. What's largely consuming your time now in InsurTech?
Just finished writing the book at the moment, looking at diving again more into the change management perspective. I think there's a huge opportunity for insurance companies to change their corporate culture, to change their, you know, mindset. Something I keep hearing from people working in the industry, that it's not very attractive, that they are struggling to attract young talents. And I believe also through some of the lessons learned when doing the research for the book, but also when talking to, you know, different companies from the Asia InsurTech podcast, I think there are some ways the insurance industry as a whole can do more to become more attractive for talent, and also change a little bit the image about insurance. And that's something that Brian actually said, who I'm, you know, wrote the book together with, or published it in his series. Like, in Asia, you find a lot of stories where insurance is actually the hero. And I think we need more of that, because I believe that the negative perception that many have of the industry is what is holding back a lot of progress, and which is making it sometimes challenging for companies to attract talent, and especially the younger generation.
Yeah, one thing I've really enjoyed about this podcast over the last several years has been identifying the societal and moral good that insurance does for people. Yeah. Like the fact that it allows humans to engage in all kinds of activities that we normally wouldn't engage in without having insurance, that innovation in insurance has allowed people to live safer, happier, more profitable, healthy lives. When bad things happen, they're not wiped out. It's not the end of their family. I mean, that you look back at human history, there were so many events that would just wipe out families. Yep. It would wipe them out financially, and then it would wipe them out practically. And so there's a lot of moral good in the insurance business. There's a lot of reasons why pooling risk makes a lot of sense for people, because it allows all of us to pay a premium to not have to worry about losing everything that we have.
I agree. And I think, you know, we should all, working in this industry, work on this narrative that, you know, how incredible insurance is. And I think that comes out in some of the stories I have in the book. And, you know, just to give you an example, I have a story of a company called Koala in Indonesia. And Indonesia is one of the countries with the lowest insurance penetration rates globally. So they have around 1.6% of GDP, whereas the US has 12.4%, and China has even, you know, close to 20. So if you have a population so unaware of the overall concept of insurance, right, but at the same time, you have a very young and tech-savvy population, 50% of the population of Indonesia is under 30 years old. These are all people who grew up like digital natives. And now having these companies who are like redefining how insurance looks like, how it's marketed to the population, and therefore also, you know, having the opportunity to create a completely new image about insurance. And Harshad Lunani, one of the founders of Koala, he said, you know, there's no great economy in the world that got to this place without being well insured, because, you know, there's going to be bumps in the road. And, you know, what you said, like, you know, families are being wiped out by tragedy. And insurance is really, you know, the tool that enables economies to achieve something greater.
Absolutely. So let's talk about Asia, because your whole book is a focus on Asia. Tell us why are you focusing on Asia? What is it that you saw when living there and operating there that made you want to write a book about it and talk about the relationship between insurance, innovation, the future of insurance, and the Asian continent?
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, as mentioned, the first time I moved to Asia was in 2009 into Hong Kong with Generali. And it was the time where Generali started a lot of their insurance carriers throughout the region, in like Indonesia and the Philippines and Thailand and India. And that's when I first understood how different the landscape there is with, you know, again, often very low insurance awareness, very low penetration. So a lot of room for growth. And where there's growth, you have just a very different market compared to, you know, my home country, Germany, which, you know, is similar to the US, very mature, but also very saturated.
Yeah, super well insured.
Super well insured. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, working in a growth market comes obviously also with challenges, but, you know, you have great opportunities and you can focus on different things, I guess. So when I then left Generali and I focused on, you know, more on the innovation and technology side and started to work with different startups, and I did a lot of research on InsurTech. That was back in 2018, 2019, when, you know, there was the big InsurTech wave. And something that I found was that there was a lot of hype on what is happening in the US, but also in Europe, but very little on what was happening in Asia, at least in, you know, the major insurance news outlets. And this is when I met Michael Waits and we decided to start the Asia InsurTech podcast to really give a platform on telling these stories, because, you know, you can't take a concept that works in a very mature market with high financial literacy and, you know, apply it to a country like India or Indonesia or, you know, even Thailand. So a lot of Asia, and especially developing Asia, needs their own solutions. And at the same time, you find a landscape that is highly digital in a way, right? Because a lot of these countries were able to leapfrog certain development stages. To give you an example, like you and I, we probably accessed the internet first time through a personal computer, you know, connected via a landline, I assume. If you talk to, you know, people in India, the majority access the internet first through a mobile phone. With the rise of smartphones and, you know, prices going down for mobile data, etc. So that has an impact on how products are marketed, right? And even still today, if you look at the traffic share you have in the US and the traffic share you have in India, you will find that still today, most accessed is through mobile phones, right? And that has an impact how companies design a user journey. Whereas in the US, you often find, you know, you had first the, you know, internet, you had a website, you access it through a desktop, and then you try to convert that into like a mobile journey. And in many cases, that's really clunky because it was not designed for mobile. But in India and, you know, other parts of developing Asia where they leapfrogged that development stage, they started straight with the mobile journey and then also designing a user journey. So people who have very little financial literacy are able to buy and understand what they are buying when it comes to financial products, right? So that I found really, really interesting. And I just wanted to give a platform.
Yeah, and we've got the classic innovator's dilemma in the United States and Europe. When you pioneer a whole suite of technologies, you end up with a lot of legacy baggage.
Yeah.
I mean, you go to an insurance carrier here in the United States or a TPA or an MGA or, you know, brokers that have been around for a while, they've digitized decades ago. And so they have old mainframe applications they have to manage. So you have that burden of legacy on the consumer side, and that you're right. I mean, I'm 44. So the first time I got on the internet was on a dial up. I was a 28.8 or a 14.4 dial up. You know, I'm talking about 14,400 bits per second. So it's very slow, very, 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 very slow modems that I dialed up on and used in the early 90s, right when dial up became a thing. And so I have a very different perspective on the evolution of technology and the internet utilization. I've been using it for a very long time through a lot of web browsers. And you're right, when you have a country that skips the entire landline phase and they skip the entire T1 phase and they go straight to just 5G modems, like, yep. or they went straight to 4G and they deploy really high speed wireless networks, everybody's on the phone. So yep. you know, like WhatsApp spread way faster in other countries than the United States. And they started using it for transacting business all over the world. And still in the United States, it's barely used. And because we have a, we just, you know, everybody here has an iPhone and we don't message that way. I mean, to the point that in the United States, if you don't have an iPhone, you're like a social pariah and people get pissed off when they text you because it's green instead of blue and they can't put you in their iMessage groups. So yeah. there's all kinds of weird things about being in a country that has, you know, prime movers advantage and has been involved there for a long time in a certain suite of technologies. It's also a great opportunity for rapid acquisition of market share in countries that skip all those generations, go straight to the latest gen, because yeah. you can reach them a lot faster, right? You can embed insurance purchases, and that's what we've seen a lot in Asia and Africa and Latin America, is completely different ways of financial transfers, of moving money. They're yep. very, very sophisticated with moving money around electronically, and they're much more willing, in my opinion, because I've been operating in Latin America for a very long time, to buying financial products a completely different way than Americans would be.
Yeah, and it's not only about, you know, the technology legacy, but also, you know, the people who have to learn a new behavior, right? Like, I can speak for Germany. Like, it might also has to do with the history of Germany, but a lot of people don't feel comfortable using like electronic payments, you know, being very digital. There's this resistance to adopt new behaviors, whereas, you know, in many parts of Asia, and, you know, one of the reasons is that in many, especially in the developing countries, you find a very young tech-savvy population. So they are also just, you know, much quicker to adopt new ways, or, you know, for them, it's the way to access financial products because they have not learned any other behavior.
Yeah, exactly. What are you most excited about in InsurTech?
What I'm most excited about, I mean, there has been a lot of talk, especially I feel this year where funding is going down and a lot of people, you know, say, okay, can we go back to, you know, regular business? Have we wasted enough money on InsurTech and all these, you know, crazy innovation strategies? I don't agree with that. I do think InsurTech, or, you know, the whole digitization of financial services has turned out a bit different. We haven't seen major disruption, etc. But what I believe it has done is it was a wake-up call to the industry that there is a necessity to change. And there is simply a necessity to change. All of our lives are changing. Even if we are not in, you know, a highly tech, digital economy like you find it in Singapore, for example. But like, we all are increasingly digital and all of our lives have changed. Our behavior has changed, you know, through the smartphone, through COVID-19 pandemic, right? And that means risks have changed, behaviors have changed. So insurance needs to change too, right? And I believe that InsurTech has really helped with that mindset change. And I think it has also inspired a lot of people working in insurance that, you know, insurance can actually be a really exciting industry. So that
can be.
Yeah, that's what I find most exciting about InsurTech.
Yeah, I mean, you have, you know, your hype cycle and then your trough of disillusionment, yeah. and then you come out of that trough, which is kind of where we're at, right? You know, funding's drying up for a lot of ideas. The ones that have been funded are seeking follow-on funding or profitability and having a hard time finding follow-on funding. And so you're going to have a shakeout. There's going to be a shakeout. There's going to be a lot of bargain acquisitions. And this is where the real solutions start to flesh out, right? I mean, there's been a lot of work on making back office processing simpler. There's been a lot of work on making policy administration and claims handling simpler. There's been a lot of work at making purchasing, quote, buying pay, a lot faster and embedding that experience in other applications, right? So there's a lot of things that they've spent a lot of investor money on that have materially changed and reset expectations for the user experience in insurance and the back office experience. I think it's equally important. I've also been impressed and not surprised at the number of companies who said, hey, we're going to cut the broker out, and now they develop technology for brokers. because they realized, I mean, there's a lot of them, that D2C is, you know, going direct to consumer is nice and extremely expensive and very challenging. And sometimes you just have to make the broker experience a whole lot better. And so I think at the end of the day, we're going to come out the other side with a healthier insurance business that's more efficient, more effective, utilizes technology, is more customer centric, utilizes a hell of a lot more data to make decisions with too. And that's the other thing, is like just database decision making is a really big positive outcome from all of this.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree, right? And it's interesting, like you talk a lot about digitizing back end and innovating along the value chain, whereas me in my book, I'm talking mostly about product design and distribution, because that is what a lot of the companies, especially in developing Asia, are focusing on, right? Because if you're in an economy where labor is not as expensive as, in the US, you have a growing market, you have different priorities. But that is also something I'm seeing when we go back to Asia. That's probably the next wave we are seeing there, is like more companies who are looking at innovations along the value chain. The first wave was really mostly about distributing products, product design, et cetera. But of course, data, et cetera, always plays a major role there.
So what's next for you? What's the big projects you're working on? Obviously, you have this book release, which is talking about the importance of paying attention to Asia. This is a global industry, so it's important not to get myopic and just look at your country. And you're identifying some great opportunities there are in Asia for people to focus on, invest in, for companies there to focus on. What's next for you? What do you think is your next big thing?
Well, I continue to work with Michael on the Asia InsurTech podcast. We have also started a new show called InsurTech Amplified this year, with me being in the US. We had over the years, and we have been running the Asia InsurTech podcast since May 2019, right? So it's over 4 years now, and had really positive feedback, and decided to add like a global show to it. But beyond that, what we do is we help insurance companies in their media strategy, because we firmly believe that every company should be a media company and control that narrative, if it is for like internal communication or external communication. So we work with different insurers on that in Asia, and with me now in the US also in this market. And I'm working with a few management consulting companies on different projects as well. And
Okay, cool. So some last questions before we go about the book. I know it's always fun, because I published my book back in November, Be Your Own VC, which is about, creating a culture of innovation and bootstrapping it. First off, where can people buy your book?
So the book is available on Amazon. If you are in the US, go to your US Amazon account. If you are somewhere else in the world, just go to your local or next best Amazon store. It will be available coming October 17th as paperback, hardcover, and also the Audible audiobook, which I recorded, which was probably the most difficult part about the whole project. Already available for pre-order is the ebook version.
Yeah, I did my own audiobook as well. And
it's different than recording a podcast, isn't it?
It's different. I've done podcasting for like 9 years now. I've been podcasting a lot for a long time, but it was definitely having to have every word precisely correct and match it exactly to the manuscript. I don't know if listeners know that, but you have to make it exactly like the book, because Amazon does this whisper sync where they sync the text and the audio up. So it's got to be perfectly exactly the same, which is always really interesting. So
correct. Yeah, and then, imagine doing it as a non-native speaker.
Yes, I know. No puedo imaginar recordándolo en español. I cannot imagine recording it in Spanish. Yeah. So it would be totally different. Writing a book in my non-native language, and then B, reading it as an audiobook. So kudos to you on that. A couple more things about your book that I wanted to kind of close out with, I thought were interesting. You did have some case studies. I'm a huge case study fan. I love case studies. I love case study based education as well. So when I got my master's in business, it was super heavy on case studies. In section two of your book, you actually have 8 case studies of different companies who are at the forefront in designing the future of insurance in their market and globally. So what can readers expect to take away from studying these case studies and reading the book?
Yeah, maybe let me take a step back about, you know, when I started working on this book, right? So because it is part of Brian Falchuk's The Future of Insurance series, yep. And he had his first book on, like, you know, incumbents, insurance carriers, then the second one on startups, and the third one is on partnerships. I decided I don't want to focus on, like, you know, startups or incumbents. I, you know, do want to focus on what I believe makes Asia special. And this is the way products are distributed and designed, how they embrace partnerships, etc. And I also wanted to give people a glimpse of, you know, what is Asia, because it's a, you know, it's the most populous continent worldwide. And we have been talking in this podcast mostly about developing Asia, but you also find countries like Japan, which is, you know, super mature and more similar to the US market than to, you know, India or even Singapore. So I picked 8 examples from different countries. I have countries from Hong Kong, Yas and One Degree. I have companies from India with PhonePe, Indonesia, Kuala. I have Malaysia with Tune Protect. I have China with Ping An, and Japan with Habito. And then Boltec, which is essentially Singapore, but they are operating globally, but, you know, they're headquartered in Singapore. And I also have this mix, right? So if you look at Ping An, which is the second largest insurance company in the world, and I tell a little bit about Ping An's history and how they got to this point, and talking about their unique ecosystem strategy and how they embrace partnerships. And it's just fascinating to see. Ping An launched in 1988, so it's not that old. But and when actually Ping An started, there were hardly any privately owned cars. Today, Ping An is the largest motor insurer in the world.
Holy cow.
I mean, it's just, you know, mind-boggling in a way. So I'm really grateful I had the opportunity to talk to the Ping An team. I talked to Jonathan Larson, the chief innovation officer, and also the head of the Global Voyager Fund, about, you know, what made Ping An what it is today, and also their strategy when it comes to, you know, insurtech and partnerships. But then I'm also happy to have Habito in the book, which is a company that just launched in June this year. So they are really, really new. And they are operating in Japan, which is not a growth market, but again, are looking at, you know, how to attract younger customers, better serve the younger generation with financial products, right? And the founder, Samantha Jotti, was previously with Singlife. Singlife also, you know, one of the success stories in Asia. And, you know, bringing that all together, I think is really beautiful to show the diversity of Asia, but at the same time showing that we all operate in the same industry, and regardless if we are, you know, one of the largest insurance companies like Ping An, or if we are a new startup, you know, we have some commonalities, and more than you might think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's I've been operating in 3 countries for the last 20 years, US and Argentina and South Africa. And I'm always impressed by the differences and the remarkable similarities between business and the countries. There's always cultural differences, but at the end of the day, we're still running business, and there's still a lot of things that can be taken away and learned from, and no matter what country you operate in.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to be learned by watching how other countries take on a similar problem in a completely different way.
And I find, you know, Asia especially interesting, and also the, you know, companies I chose, to see how they are looking at especially attracting millennials and Generation Z And that's the case for the developing countries, but also Habito in Japan, who, you know, really is trying in an aging society. Japan has actually the highest median age of any country in the world, right?
Yep.
Over 50%.
A lot of empty houses now, too, because they have a declining population and they're in population collapse. Yeah.
And, but still over 50% of the wealth is, you know, allocated with people older than 65. So naturally, a lot of financial institutions, including insurance, have been targeting, you know, this older segment. But what they found now, what Habito found, was that the younger generation looks at, you know, a different way to be approached, to be marketed to, etc. And that's what they are trying to do. In the Japanese market yet. It's obviously too early to say if they are successful, but it's still a very valuable lesson, I think, how they tackle this problem and also how they take experiences. Samantha Jotti has, you know, formerly been with Singlife. And what I also find happy coincidence, actually, Walter the Older, who is the founder of Singlife, he has now left Singlife, started a new venture, but he has actually agreed to write the foreword and talks about the lessons he learned when, you know, founding Singlife. And later they acquired Aviva, which was the largest insurance deal in Singapore's history. So, you know, it's like this cycle of innovation, starting with the foreword by Walter, founder of Singlife, and then having Samantha, who was, you know, a part of his team, starting her own company in Japan.
Awesome. That's a great example. Great story. And I'm excited about your book and your audiobook, and kudos and congratulations on the release. I know how much work that takes. It's a lot. And I'm impressed, and I hope you enjoy living in New York City as long as you live there. It's an exciting place, and from an insurance perspective, fantastic. You couldn't pick a better place to be for great insurance events, and taking the train up to Hartford and going to Mecca.
So yeah, I'm really, really looking forward. So the first few months were a bit, you know, finishing the book, still focusing mainly on Asia and just getting settled, you know, how the housing market in New York is. It took us a while to find our way. But yeah, now really excited to learn more about, the innovation space in the U.S.
Awesome. Sounds wonderful. Well, Teresa, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it. And everybody, please check out her book. Again, that is The Future of Insurance, Asia Rising. And again, you can check that out on all your usual book sources, ebooks and physical books and audibles with her voice, which is also exciting. I'll always have the author read it. So thanks again, Teresa. And everybody, please check that out. And thank you, listener, for tuning in today to Geek Out, our interview with Teresa Blissing, author of The Future of Insurance, Asia Rising. See you next time.
The InsurTech Geek Podcast is all about technology that's transforming and disrupting the insurance world. I've been your host, James Benham, that's jamesbenham.com, with co-host Rob Galbraith at endofinsurance.com. We're taking you on a journey through insurance tech, so enjoy the ride and geek out.